Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Let's start the session once again. There's not a big crowd here in the classroom, but the guys that are here are even more intensive in terms of their attention to these things. So first of all, I would like to remind you that I've now downloaded some new material to the Moodle site. First of all, Jari Mikkes lectures for regarding regulation next week are there already. And then I just got yesterday a very recent publication from the ECB that actually discusses in very much details the role of climate change in future development of ECB monetary policy. And that is really, really an interesting thing there. It's a huge report. It's an ECB occasional paper that was published actually 1 week ago. And it's in connection to the change in the ECB monetary policy framework or the review of the framework. So take a close look at that. Actually, it gives very good, also high level academic references that are related to these things. But since the things that are reported there are just now kind of opinions of a big number of researchers in the ECB participant banks and at the ECB level, they are not belonging to the mandate still, but they might be there actually already next year. So take a look at that report if anyone of you is interested in doing research in your thesis, for example, regarding the role of climate change in sort of building up the new monetary policy frameworks. Put it in a few words, it's really difficult task because it introduces the problem of this physical transition, physical risks, and also the transition risks, how to measure those. What are all the relevant parts of the economy that are involved in there? And one of the biggest roles is being played by the financial markets. And one of the things that have already been trading there quite actively or form of assets are the green bonds. They actually give one chapter there at the end of the report regarding the trading with green bonds by the central banks. So it's really interesting report in terms of the possibilities that I have been already mentioning. I had no idea about this occasional paper that is forthcoming actually. I already discussed about these possibilities of revising the contents of unconventional monetary policy asset purchase programs towards these green markets. And they are actually now discussing about those things also. There are dozens of very high-level economists that belong to the central banking ECB system. So they are either working at the individual banks, central banks, or at the ECB in Frankfurt. So they are now really focusing on these things also. And my suggestion or idea already a couple of weeks ago was that the central banks will be the major player also in these regards. And that is going to be the case. Yeah.
Sorry. And we've been speaking about digital banking last year.
Yeah.
Which one is going to be like the main focus in like central bank policies? Is environment or is like going to digital? Because
they have to be joint. Digitalization of the banking system and introducing of central bank digital currency has to play a role in also this unconventional monetary policy action that the central banks are probably doing in the near future regarding the green transition. So it will be, they have to be considered together. You cannot separate guys that would be focusing only on digitalization or central bank digital currency, and the other guys would be discussing about green transition and the things related to that. You cannot do that. It's not possible. You have to be able to sort of make an optimal mix of these things? How can you use the digitalization of the financial system to enhance or lower the premia that are related to the green trading in the green finance assets? I think that is the main thing there. They are not actually saying it in such a plain words as I am used to be saying my things, but that's my opinion. You cannot separate these two things from each other. You have to discuss about this together. But nevertheless, the main thing still in the future will be this focusing on the price stability at the aggregate level, because that is the thing that actually introduces also a lot of unrest in the aggregate economies between the nations, for example. The countries that are suffering from high inflation rate are probably also suffering from low rates of investment in terms of green finance assets, for example. So it's probably going to be pretty much impossible for the developing countries that are experiencing high levels of inflation to sort of lure the investment flows to go there regarding financing the green transition. So that is really important still. And in also that report, the economists want to emphasize that the price stability, inflation stability, is among the perhaps key factors still in the near future. And now that you have seen the huge rises in energy prices, for example, in the UK, they are now more or less horrified about the winter. How will be they able to warm up their houses when the natural gas prices have tripled during a very short period of time? I've lived 1 year there in the UK, and it's really a disaster if the prices triple there because you use the natural gas for heating your houses. So the price stability is really important thing. And the energy sector plays here also a really important thing. And speculation in the energy sector assets plays a big role here. And that is actually one of the reasons why I myself also am focusing on these green finance and energy finance things. I've been doing a lot of research about the profitability of banks during these unconventional times, but also about the green finance and energy finance themes. Because to my mind, speculation in energy-related asset markets is really harmful for the future development of real economic activity. If the futures prices of a certain energy-related asset deviate too much from the spot prices, and the spot prices start to follow the development of futures prices, then the price increase in the spot markets is completely speculation-based. That's a bad thing for the market participants. And it actually induces more inflation based on completely unnecessary reasons. It's just based on speculation. So the derivatives markets try to pay a very good attention to Juhani's teaching in his derivatives course, because he's talking about the modeling of these things in terms of the theoretical models and empirical approaches. They are really important in this respect. So we are talking about nominal anchor in this case. Even though we are always, as an optimizing agent, we would be optimizing our real economic behavior. We want to optimize or maximize our real consumption. But the thing that we get to be reported regularly also in the financial news or other economic news in the general media are nominal things, actually. You really don't get quotations for real values in the markets very much. But the real behavior is the one that also the central bankers are interested, because that's the thing that you are interested about as an economic agent. You want to maximize your real consumption. You want to maximize your real profits as a firm owner from your firm to be able to maximize your consumption possibilities based on that part of your income. So we get these nominal things from the markets. So in terms of these relevant variables for the central bank, We have already been discussing quite a lot about money supply. How does the basis or base of money get to be determined, and what is its relationship to inflation? That will be that we will be discussing today. So it's the thing that we get from the markets. So that's the reason why the central banks, actually, even though their theoretical models are based on real variables and real values, they focus on nominal things. They think that they have an effect on nominal things. They try to affect on nominal things. So as a sophisticated economist, you have to understand this difference. The underlying reason for central bankers to do anything is the real economic behavior of the aggregate economy, consumers and firms and so on. But the thing that they can have an effect on is a nominal thing. Nominal interest rates, nominal changes in prices. That's the inflation rate. Obviously, if it can be the case, at least in earlier times, it could be the case that when the policymakers change, and this is now connected to the central bank policymakers, so the board of governors changes, it might be the case that they have some reasons to change the previously issued targets. But this is nowadays actually not a actually relevant problem anymore, because all the modern central banks are nowadays focusing very much on the price stability, completely irrespective of the contents or the composition of their board of governors. Price stability is the thing that they want to focus on. So even though it has been historically already there, actually at the Bank of Finland, we issued this target level for low inflation already after the 1990s crisis. We were among the first ones. Bank of New Zealand also issued this same target, and many other Western countries actually issued the same thing. But there might be some other goals, and obviously there are also other goals, because the real economic activity is the thing that the central bankers also bear in their minds, playing a huge role in the background. They might be focusing also on the nominally measured output development. So they have an idea that they can control the inflation rate more or less completely. So they would also be able to combine an optimal level for the target of output changes also. It's not the case that it's some kind of a matter of choosing between two sides of the same coins. How much do you want to emphasize the inflation rate, and how much do you want to emphasize the real economic activity? Both these guys are included into the most heavily used simple rule for monetary policy actions, i.e. the Taylor rule. And in that Taylor rule, you actually parameterize the effect of prospective changes in economic growth to the main steering rates of the central banks. Stability of financial markets is also an interesting thing. I actually just wrote recently a paper regarding whether it's actually something that is being focused the most during the crisis periods. And I used an indicator for the stability of the or the uncertainty of the financial markets in the form of VIX index, volatility index from the stock markets. And I actually found the result that at the tail observations level of those VIX index, the unconventional monetary policy actions are really connected to controlling these extreme observations most heavily. So stability of financial markets does really play a role there, even though it's not parameterized into the central bank's target functions at all. The standard target function is still based on the Taylor rule. So they are focusing on real economic activity, deviations of that from the optimal level or the long run trend level, and also deviations of actual inflation from the target level of inflation. Obviously, stabilization of interest rates, it's an obvious thing based on these ideas. Central bank wants to stabilize every segment in the financial market. So the interest rate asset markets are one segment of the asset markets. So if they want to stabilize the financial markets in general, obviously the interest-yielding asset markets are one part of that. Then the stability in foreign exchange markets, which means the stabilization of your currency value. It played a bigger role, for example, in small central banks like the Bank of Finland before we joined the euro. Now this mandate or this part of the mandate is being left to the ECB. So it defends the value of the euro. And it wants to stabilize that, especially with respect to the US dollar. That's probably the main preference exchange rate for the euro development. Then there's this always ongoing discussion about the whether this price stability is the primary or is it still relevant to have it. And based on that, yesterday issued ECB occasional paper, even in the forthcoming climate change conditions, it's still the main thing actually. Because various parts of the sectors that are going to be affected by the climate change, there are supply sectors, supply parts, demand parts, financial markets, general uncertainty, exchange rates, currency markets, and so on. There's a nice list there. If you don't want to read the whole 197-page report immediately, take at least a look at the executive summary of that. There's some nice tables there about the main ideas in the worries regarding the climate change. What are the main parts of economy and markets that the climate change is going to be affecting and how? If you consider these physical risks and transition risks as the two main classifications regarding the climate risks, climate change risks. So we have been discussing about these hierarchical mandates and dual mandates. So the first one here puts the goal of price stability first and then says that as long as it's achieved, other goals can be pursued. More or less, the current sort of a doctrine is still giving the same message. So dual mandates want to make a much more clear distinction between price stability and maximum employment, but they seem to be interconnected actually, at least to a degree still. So the price stability is still the primary long-run goal of monetary policy, also in the future. You can check that from the ECB report. I had some doubts that whether they are now actually loosening up a bit in terms of this, but they are not doing that. They have now just defined more clearly that it is the 2% inflation, the annual inflation level that the central bank is targeting, and the deviations above and below that target are treated in a symmetric way. It's equally bad if we are over the 2% compared to the situation when we are below that. So they will be doing their actions in a similar sort of a power, regardless of at which side we are in reference to the 2% level of inflation. So basically, price stability is the one that dictates. So it's not actually nowadays anymore even so relevant to discuss about these two mandates, because the mandates are now actually focusing still very much on the price stability. So it's about the inflation targeting all the time. And one of the key things there is to always be able to give a public announcement of the targets. And now they have issued the most recent public announcement for the ECB case was issued in July this summer. And it's that 2% exact target. And they have to be committed to that price stability as the main long-run goal of monetary policy, and they are committed to achieve that Now there's going to be we are lucky enough now to have the UK exited from the European Union, because the ECB don't have to pay too much attention to the huge rises, in general rises, in the UK at the moment. But it will be having an effect also on the interest rates in the UK. So Bank of England is now playing a big role there, whether it wants to control these inflation pressures that are originating from the energy sector mainly there, and from other things that are related to the availability of the labor force for the main important sectors. It was the fuel truck drivers that was the problem now. You cannot get the fuel from the gas stations at the moment. It's sold out. I have not experienced this kind of thing during my life. I'm much older than you. So it's really interesting thing at the moment. It will be having a clear effect on the inflation in the UK. And the next question is that what is the Bank of England going to be doing for that? Is it willing to increase the interest rate? Because based on the Taylor rule and target for the low inflation that they also have, they should be doing that now. But it's a supply-based shock. It's not a demand-based shock. So it's a completely different shock. It doesn't give a very good reason for the central bank to increase the interest rate. It's based on the non-availability of some items that are relevant in the consumer price index, like the energy. So it's a supply shock now. And that actually gives also the Bank of England the room not to increase interest rate, even though the inflation would be increasing. But when they have low interest rate in nominal terms, and they will be experiencing higher inflation rate, obviously their real rate of interest will get lower and lower. So that is something that should actually be of benefit to the UK economy once they survive from this crisis. It will take a while, and we will be seeing what happens in general terms in the economy, because it might not be the only sector that is suffering from the Brexit now really heavily. So I know that some of my colleagues in Ireland are now laughing because the British guys are suffering about really tremendously about this Brexit. They forecasted, for example, Brian Lucy forecasted that it's going to be a disaster, and it is a disaster now there. But it's not a matter of to be sort of a laughing, because it's a really, really difficult situation. Bank of England now plays the key role there. Is it still willing to use unconventional monetary policy actions to save the economy? Does it help? It's not about investments. It's once again a supply shock, like the corona crisis. It's the same thing. Yeah.
Yes. For example, we have this situation with fuel. Bank of England is going to do some things. It's going to like increase interest rate or what? But this situation is not going to be solved until the government is going to intervene. So, for example, if this crisis will last, let's say, after Christmas, Easter time, which is what's going to do Bank of England, for example?
Well, they don't have very much. The Bank of England doesn't have very much tools except these unconventional tools to keep the economy going on and the final sector going on. It might be that the energy firms start to collapse. They have to be saved somehow. And it's once again the central bank that is being sort of a crowd out whether they can help or not. It's really interesting to see how long this crisis is going to be lasting there, and what are the effects of this crisis to the government. Will the prime minister survive from this? It can be a big question. So we are now experiencing really interesting real economic effects of the Brexit, actually. We didn't have these earlier, because we were discussing about, we had this other crisis. We had this corona crisis that was also a supply shock, complete supply shock. But this is not basically related to the corona anymore. It's related to the Brexit. you cannot get the drivers, truck drivers, to drive the fuel to the gas stations. It's really real economic thing that is happening there. Okay, so it's about, once again, the role of central bank. And in terms of this inflation targeting, it should be able to somehow now also in this crisis situation issue some kind of saving, let's say, program. What are going to be the steps that it will be willing to do or take to save the real economic sector, at least for some parts of it. So there are lots of things that in normal times should be the ones that have an effect on the steering rates. But now we are once again living a shock there. So basically in these situations, these mainly interesting things like the inflation deviation from its target level and the real economic activity deviation from its potential level are not the things basically at the moment in short term that the central bank is focusing. It will be having an effect on these variables actually in the near future, but at the moment the crisis is the thing that you have to somehow solve. You have to be able to do something there. So obviously, if this is something that starts to affect the financial sector also, it will be then even more clearly included to the target function of the central bank. Because one of the things that the central bank focuses is the financial stability. What are the effects of these things to the financial sector? If the firms related to the energy sector start to collapse, they go bankruptcy, it will have an effect on the bank profitability, and it will have an effect on the financial markets based on that. So there might be, we might experience now a starting point for some kind of crisis in the UK economy or UK financial markets. And for that purpose, the central bank of UK might be, or Great Britain might be interested in doing something. So, but there are also, the interest rates in the UK were actually rising to more normal levels already before the corona crisis. So you were able to get some kind of arbitrage returns, both from the US markets and also from the UK markets compared to the European markets. But these crisis events have actually returned the path of the interest rates back to lower, close to the lower zero bound, actually. But let's see what happens there in the UK in any case. So we have tried to learn some lessons from the global financial crisis of 2007-2009. One of the key things is that is there actually a reason to include some kind of measure for the volatility or uncertainty in financial markets to the target function of the central banks? They don't admit that it is there in their target function, but it's there playing at the background. And the main reason for that is, first of all, to save the banking sector. But it has introduced also the possibility, because the amount of liquidity is so huge in the banking sector now, and still there are huge amounts of real economic uncertainties. So those funds are not being channeled as new loans to real investments. They are going towards more like financially related investments, so speculative investments. So it might be the case, some of the economists are strongly claiming, for example, Campbell Harvey is strongly claiming at the moment that the central banks themselves have been the causes or the reason for this emergence of bubbles. I'm not quite willing to say the same thing, because the original idea of the central banks was to save the banking sector. It, the next step was decided by the banks. What did they want to do with the funding, extra funding? So we can make these distinctions between bubble periods or bubble experiments. The first one is the credit-driven bubble, and the subprime crisis is a good example of that. It's related to the too high innovations, too high amount of innovations and inventing very difficult forms of assets in the banking sector. And then there are these bubbles that are driven solely by irrational behavior at the secondary markets of assets. So for example, mainly in the stock markets and also nowadays in the commodities markets. And this is the thing that is really worrying for me, because I think that's really relevant for the energy sector development in the future. If the speculation in the futures markets and the derivatives markets for energy-related assets is high and it has an effect on the spot price, then it will clearly have an effect on the production processes of these energy-related products. So it's really a thing that you probably would have to be even worried nowadays compared to the period of global financial crisis. Because the financialization of the commodity market started to develop really rapidly after 2012, especially. Various forms of futures agreements were issued at that time for almost every kind of assets in the commodity markets. So you have futures now for all the agricultural products, you have futures for all the forms of energy, you have futures for all the forms of precious metals, normal metals, non-ferrous metals, and so on. So the speculative possibility is obvious in all these markets. It's a thing that actually really worries me quite a lot. Main question is that, should the central banks respond to bubbles? What is your opinion? Should they be responding? Don't pay too much attention to my statement there. Give your own opinion. Based on the things that you have learned here and in your previous studies, what is your own opinion about this?
Well, I think there is some moral hazard risk.
Yeah.
And my personal opinion is that we should focus some attention to the size of banks. In that way, take some control of the risk, and in that way, when the bank size would be controlled, then we shouldn't have such a need for strong regulation at the same time. It would also make more room for fintech innovation. But a small, short answer is I think they shouldn't take every role.
Okay, so I got a short answer here that the central bank should not pay too much attention to these bubbles. What about the case if they have themselves caused those bubbles? Should they do something with respect to that? Is it possible for them to do anything now? What would this require if they suddenly would admit that there are bubbles in the markets? What are the possibilities for the central banks to do? What can they do now? Can they do anything?
Well, I think it's print more money and hope that instead of bursting the bubble risk, like how stable instead of like.
Yeah, and that would be based on printing more money,
yeah.
Still more liquidity to the system. Well, that's a never-ending story. You would have to be printing until the markets themselves realize that there is a bubble. Then it would only break. But as an, let's say, standard economist, I would very much like to sort of swear on behalf of the functioning of market mechanism. So basically, the bursting of bubbles should be done perhaps by someone else than the central banks. So in that case, it would be actually reflecting the main idea that the central banks are focusing on the real economic development, because they didn't originally have the intention to have these external or these excess funds to be directed towards financial investments like the banking sector did. And you raised a really important question there about the regulation of banks. Nowadays, the regulation of banks is basically given also by the central banks, because these companies or these institutions or these identities that do the supervision actually are doing that under the control of the central bank. Actually, most of the people are actually getting their paycheck from the central bank, almost all of them. So the first thing here would be to separate these two things from each other. Central bank is independent from surveillance or regulations. Is that a possible thing? Perhaps not for the banking sector, because the main idea of the central bank behavior is to give liquidity and funds to the real economic sector through the banking sector. So it would be actually advisable that the central bank has a say there on what purposes are the banks using that funding. So it's actually the original idea of joining these supervisory things with the central bank is actually this. So they would be able to monitor. So it would be reducing the moral hazard problem based on that. That is the thing there. So you cannot basically blame, like some of the economists or finance professors are nowadays blaming, that the central banks are the root cause for the bubbles at the moment. They didn't have that idea originally. They wanted to save the banking sector, but the fundamental target for them was to save the real economic activity. They assumed that the main channeling of funds would go through the banking sector, the real economic behavior, firms and households. So it's not perhaps fair to blame the central banks for the things that the banks or the bankers decided. Obviously, when you have very low interest rates, it's not profitable to invest to any other interest rating assets. So they started to seek for possibilities to invest to something else. Invented new firms as the subsidiaries of the banks and did the investments to the stock markets and related derivatives and so on. And got the very good profits from there. So, but in any case, macroprudential policy is the thing that actually gathers together all the main important concepts regarding regulatory policy measures to affect what is happening in the credit markets in the aggregate. So they are designed especially to prohibit the development of the credit-originated bubbles. So macroprudential policies are designed for that. We have a specific course for this form of regulation that you can take actually. It is given by the specialist at the Bank of Finland, because it's the thing that the central banks do. Monetary policy is also the thing that the central banks do. And the main thing here is to take care of the fact that the central bankers and other regulators should not have a laissez-faire attitude and let credit-driven bubbles proceed without any reaction. So they should be discussing actively with each other. The guys that are doing the supervision and regulatory actions should be in active contact with the persons that are in charge of the monetary policy actions, because they should be basically the two sides of the same coin. Okay, and that's actually the reason why the macroprudential things are in the control of central bankers nowadays. But in general terms, the tools that are being used in normal times are these open market operations and reserve requirements and discount rates that is equal to the marginal lending facility in the ECB case in normal times. But in addition to this, these unconventional monetary policy tools have been used in crisis periods, and they are still there, heavily used, as you have observed from my figures, reporting the extension of the central bank's balance sheets. They are really high level at the moment. So you obviously have to also discuss about those things. But we want to make a distinction between these conventional and non-conventional monetary policy actions and tools. Actually, the ECB occasional paper doesn't very much discuss about this thing, but unless only for the part of the role of the green bonds market at the moment. What is the role of central banks in the green bonds market? And it's starting to increase. So we have these tools, and then we have these policy instruments that are in aggregate terms given as reserve aggregates and interest rates, and they may be linked to an intermediate target that can be sort of understood by the general public more easily, like, for example, an inflation rate. So it's easy to understand what is the inflation rate that is connected to an intermediate target in the form of changes in the money supply. So an intermediate target is the money supply development, and that is connected to the interest rates, and that should be connected to the inflation development. So based on an idea, what kind of inflation you are targeting level, at which level you are targeting the inflation, then the central bank, and just in aggregate terms, makes a decision that about the relevant level of interest rates that is in connection to that inflation rate, and what is the change in the money supply that should be in connection to that level of interest rate. We have been discussing already about these connections in this course. So if you are doing a loosening monetary policy action, what is your idea about the future inflation rate? Is it going to be too high or is it going to be too low? As a central banker, if you want to do a loosening monetary policy action, what does it mean in terms of money supply and in terms of interest rate?
Monetary policy increases the supply.
Yeah.
Interest rate goes down.
Yeah. So loosening monetary policy, need for a loosening monetary policy comes from the idea that the central banker is seeing that inflation rate is too low with respect to the target level in the future. So it will be increasing the money supply, and that is actually also resembling the idea that the interest rate will be lower. It will be decreasing. And it should have a positive effect on inflation in terms of economic activity. So positive change in the money supply is in connection to the increasing price level, i.e. positive inflation rate, change in the inflation rate. So obviously the things that you have to be able to measure are obviously interest rates, and we have discussed about these quite a lot. So you should now understand this actually in terms of the supply and demand of the reserves in the banking sector, because the effects on the inflation rate get to be channeled through the changes in the demand and supply of reserves, especially excess reserves that are channeled in the form of loans to the real sectors in the economy, businesses and consumers, households. So the main idea is that, first of all, it's well observable and you can measure the amount of that, and then you can control that, and then you have some idea what are the effects of changes in that policy instrument with respect to your main targets in your central bank target function. So even nowadays, even though we are nowadays living an era of climate change that will be affecting on everything, it will be the case still that the central banks are interested at the fundamental level on the effects of the climate change on these two guys, inflation rate and output gap. And John Taylor made a very nice sort of an innovation in 1993 based on empirical observations about the development of Fed funds rate target. We have been discussing about that yesterday. It's now between 0 and 0.25 in the Federal reserve system, it has been much, much higher in the data that John Taylor used, actually, from 1970s until the end of 1980s. It was clearly much higher. Around the peaks were around 20% in annual terms. He found an empirical relationship. There's no theoretical background actually behind this. He just found empirically that it's a fact in the US economy that you can give a very good approximation for the level of Fed funds target rate when you have an idea about the annual inflation rate and an annual, at the annual level, equilibrium real Fed funds rate. Equilibrium refers to the situation when all the productive capacity in the economy is in full use. So you basically don't have any other forms of unemployment than just the structural form of unemployment. So you're actually discussing about the level of economic activity in that case, where the interest rate is at the so-called natural level of interest rate. That is also the thing that the ECB is now focusing in that new occasional paper when they are discussing about the climate change effects. They want to discuss about the effect on the natural rate of interest. What is the natural rate of interest after the some things in the climate change effects have realized in terms of having effects on the demand and the supply side? What is the new natural rate of interest? Then Taylor also found that in empirical terms, half of the inflation gap refers here to the deviation of the actual inflation from the target level or the long run trend level. In those times, they didn't actually have a permanent target level for the inflation in the US economy, but that was sort of a proxied by the trend in the inflation. And then half of that effect comes from the output gap. And output gap is referring now to the difference between the actual output and the equilibrium natural rate of output when all the production sort of components are in full use. So there's no basically unemployment and capital is also in full use. So the main two things there that change over time when you get more observations are these inflation gap and output gap. So basically in terms of econometric equation that we'll be discussing in the spring term, you can add here actually a subscript T. So you can measure this. So you can do a time series regression for this thing. So you have an observation for the Fed funds rate target at time T. It can vary at the monthly level actually. And it's actually decided at the weekly frequency, actually. It can be fairly constant for a longer period of time, but then it can suddenly change. Then you have another thing, inflation, actual inflation there. You can also that observe at the monthly level, at least. You have, then you are able to also calculate the inflation gap and also the output gap. So in empirical regressions after the Taylor paper, in terms of the output observations, they usually have been using GDP that you can observe at the quarterly level, but also industrial production. I have been using industrial production when I have tested Taylor equations that you can observe at the monthly level. But nevertheless, the main thing here is that this is a regression equation. It's an empirical equation. So inflation gap and output gap are the things that are relevant. When the central bank wants to stabilize these things, it will be focusing on the need to change the Fed funds rate if the inflation gap increases and if the output gap increases. So the positive coefficients in front of these two animals refer to the situation that when your actual inflation is higher than the target inflation, it will have a positive effect with the coefficient of 0.5 to the Fed fund target. And when the output is above the potential output or the natural rate of output, the same goes on. So this is related to the situation that obviously when you have negative observations here, when your inflation is below the target level and output it is also below the target level, you will lower the Fed funds target because you want to boost the economy and you want to boost the inflation. So the main thing here to understand is the sign of the coefficient, not so much the size. In the US data based on Taylor's paper, this coefficient size of 0.1, 0.5 for both of these guys seem to be relevant. But we have estimated, many economists have estimated the Taylor rules for other economies, and they are not necessarily the same. I have done that in my paper that I also downloaded, by the way, to the Moodle site for the OECD countries. Small euro area countries, bigger euro area countries, countries outside the euro area, and so on. And I found that actually this coefficient varies quite a lot between the countries. So you cannot basically impose this restriction that comes from the US data to be holding also in other countries' data. So output gap is an indicator of future inflation. So basically, through the using of output gap in this regression model, the inflation gets to be taken into account based on the actual ex post observations and also based on the expectations. Because based on the so-called Phillips curve idea that we'll be discussing in the slides later, the output gap is an indicator of future inflation. So if the output gap increases at the moment, it will be indicating inflation pressures in the future. So expectations are also, expectations of inflation also get to be taken into account. So that kind of gives you an idea about the forward-looking role, forward-looking variables in the Taylor equation. Okay, so this Nairu definition here refers to the idea that already I mentioned here, that we assume here that the reference value for the target value for the output is referring to the Nairu level of unemployment. So that means that all the productive sort of inputs are at full use in the economy. So there's no pressure for inflation to change at that point. But if the actual output deviates from that, then there is also a pressure coming from the future expectations of inflation or expectations of future inflation. And it will be having an effect also on the Fed funds rate. As I already mentioned, I downloaded this paper of mine to the Moodle site, and it's just an example about the possibility of missing variables in this equation. Because obviously nowadays we are discussing about the role of financial markets quite a lot. Can you parameterize that to a Taylor model? Can you include some kind of financial market performance measure there that would have a role? Then one of the possibilities for the mandates of, or the partial mandates of the central bank would be that it's focusing on the currency value. So is there a relevant measure for that? Real exchange rate with respect to your main trading partners in the international trade would be a thing that perhaps should be parameterized also in this model. And I do an analysis in that paper with one of our PhD students, Samu Kärkkäinen, and my colleague Kari Heimonen. And we include the dividend yield that we have actually been discussing also here. That's the primary fundamental in the valuation of stock market assets, the dividends. We are including the dividend yield and the real exchange rate as more or less ad hoc variables, because the original Taylor rule is an ad hoc equation. It's an empirical equation. We don't have a closed form solution in terms of theoretical model that what would be the relevant form of funds market information in these equations. We include that to the paper, to the analysis of these OECD countries, and we find out that perhaps it's the case that the actual Taylor rule looks like something like this, with varying coefficients on the role of inflation cap and output cap in different countries, in OECD countries, but the central banks actually take also into account the information that comes from the stock markets and the currency markets, but like an instrumental variable. So they have an effect on the inflation and they have an effect on the output gap, but they are not components of the actual Taylor rule. So we use a sophisticated estimation procedure titled dynamic GMM, generalized method of moments procedure. So that's an instrumental variable regression. So basic idea there is that we first regress these most relevant guys against those additional information, get the fitted value from that regression equation, and use those fitted values as additional variables there in the actual regression, whether they are statistically significant or not. That gives you an answer whether they have a role or not. It's not actually so simple because it's a maximum likelihood estimation. It's not an OLS regression. So we don't actually report parameter estimates for these instruments at all, but we focus on the sizes of these coefficients when we take the instruments and don't take those, and whether the statistical significance of these coefficients changes. And it does change in almost all cases. So that paper is actually one of the articles that Samu is going to be included in his PhD thesis, and it has been also already referred quite many times in the literature. So it seems to be a relevant way to think about these things. So this is a US representation, but this is a US case based on data before 1993. So it's really old data. Probably it's actually nowadays the case that the Taylor rule might not work at all. What could be the reason for that? If you take a data from 2008 up until now, so you get a 13 years data set, you have monthly observations for the variables, so you get enough observations to done to the regressions. What is the problem in these data? What is the thing that doesn't basically vary at all? So can you do a valid regression model for that data? What is the thing that doesn't vary nowadays basically at all? It has not varied for many years.
Inflation
has actually varied quite a lot.
Interest rate,
the left-hand variable there, the regressant in this regression model, it has not basically varied at all. So if you want to test the Taylor rule, functioning of the Taylor rule in the most recent observation for the US market, for example, it might not get you very nice results. Actually, we had the data in our data set, also observations from this zero lower bound period, but not too much because our data ended in the paper to 2016 or 15, something like that. And it was varying enough, but you have to always be careful in these empirical modelings that do you have enough variability in your data sample regarding the variables? Do they vary enough? Because if they don't vary, it's really difficult to explain them by anything else that varies. Because it's a constant level. You cannot explain that. So basically the functioning of Taylor rule, if you want to test that in modern data, it obviously would require additional variables, not just these original simple guys here. Okay, but it's a nice thing. You can obviously try to do that. But if you want to do that, you want to do your thesis for testing the Taylor rule during the negative interest rate era or zero lower bound era, come and discuss first with me what would be the relevant things that you also have to include there. You have to include quite a lot of things there. But as you see from this data series, so basically in the original paper, the Taylor was lucky enough to be able to utilize data series that vary quite a lot. And it seems to be the case that after he estimated that equation that I gave you there, he was able to mimic the behavioral Fed funds rate quite, at least the changes in the trend, quite well. Not perhaps always the level in the actual Fed funds rate, but the changes in the trends. And that is fair enough. That is a good enough approximation because the regression model gets a very nice R squared value. So the power of explanatory power of the regression model in those cases is actually quite good when you are able to detect the changes in the trends. So, but the problem here in the most recent data is the one that I already raised up. The Fed funds rate does not vary basically at all. So it's probably, even though the Taylor rule might give you an idea that the Fed funds rate should be somewhere here, the reality is completely different. It has been there at the zero lower bound. It started to increase around 2016 until 2019, but it's now once again there at the zero lower level. So it's an interesting animal. It obviously requires, if you want to use a regression model to explain behavior of the Fed funds rate in the most recent data, you have to have something else there than just these standard variables, inflation gap and production gap or real activity gap. And you can actually download these data sets from that St. Louis, very nice Fed Bank of St. Louis dataset, if you want to do this analysis. We have also data stream here in Uvascular that you can use to extract series if you want to do a global analysis of Taylor rule in some countries. Okay, let's go now to the theme three. What are the standard theories behind these monetary policy actions? Do they still hold? Yes, the general message is that actually they do hold, because the general idea is that everything is based on the supply of money. How does the money supply affect? Regardless of what are the ultimate purposes where the money is being used, it should have a role, because that's basically the main thing, or the first thing that the central bank can more or less dictate, or it has the strongest power to affect on that one. Okay, what are the main theories behind these monetary policy actions? We start from this quantity theory of money that was originally introduced by Irving Fisher in 1930s, and Milton Friedman that got actually a Nobel Prize from this development of this original idea of Irving Fisher. Even further, was another so-called classical school economist that was focusing on these things. So these are the two perhaps most important classical school guys in economics that have been analyzing or introducing these concepts. So there are some definitions. The first thing is the money supply. That is the thing that the central bank is supposed to have almost full control of. And it is the thing that is still holding. Price level, that's related to the real economic behavior. What is the general level of prices at the aggregate, as an aggregate measure? Then aggregate output in real terms. This is why I forgot to give it here, that is measured here in real terms. So that gives you a link to the real economic behavior. That should be in the focus of the central bank. Then if you multiply like real income or real output with the price level, you get the aggregate nominal income. Note that we are not discussing about time series yet here. These are just definitions of the variables and descriptions of the relationships between these and what kind of definitions can we construct based on these original definitions that are relevant in doing monetary policy. One of the main things here in the Fisherian approach was that he assumed that the velocity of money is constant. And the first thing that John Maynard Keynes wanted to actually skip is that the velocity of money cannot be assumed to be constant, actually, at least not in long term. By definition, we define the velocity of money to be measuring the average number of times per year that a dollar or a currency unit is spent. So that basically you cannot understand in that irrespective of whether it's measured in digital form or something else, when that token that you're using now comes to your use in your electronic wallet the next time, if you can somehow tokenize or mark that specific item of money, you draw a cross to a note to specify that it has been in your wallet at this time, when it is going to be there the next time. So how many times per year is it going to be there? That describes sort of a circulation of the money, velocity of the money in the economy. And that is still a relevant thing nowadays, even though the forms of money have changed quite a lot. So by definition, we can calculate the velocity of money based on this nominal aggregate, nominal income, nominal GDP divided by the money supply. So it's a nominal thing. We are dividing nominal measure with a nominal measure. It's still a nominal thing. Then we can get the equation of change by just multiplying both sides with the amount of money. So you should immediately understand that if something changes on the right-hand side of this definition, let's say that P changes, but Y doesn't change. So the nominal price level changes, but Y doesn't change. So if you assume that this is constant, then obviously M also has to change. It has to change for the definition to hold. The main sort of a disturbing assumption here is that velocity is assumed to be constant. Well, it's not basically holding anymore, but it's a good starting point to understand the things that are related to each other in terms of this equation of exchange. So next, we list up here the main characteristics of this Fisherian quantity theory of money. Velocity is fairly constant in short run, but he also admitted that it might be not the case in the shorter, in the longer run. It might be changing when you compare, let's say, annual or five-year averages of the velocity. It might not be the change, the same. Because mediums of exchange also change. And nowadays, when we have electronic forms of cash, it's really easy to sort of circulate more money in the economy in a shorter period of time. So the velocity has obviously increased also based on this electronic forms of cash. That should be actually something that should be also helping in terms of enhancing the role of money supply to the economy. Because if you increase velocity, you would need less money supply to have the same P times Y value, the nominal aggregate GDP value. So changes in money supply affect only the price level here. That's the second assumption that was basically, or the third assumption that was basically given by Fisher originally, and we assume also that we don't have any unemployment. Aggregate output is at the full employment level. Well, is it the case? Usually, no. It's really rare to have this. So there are lots of sort of a kind of a contradictory assumptions in this original formulation. Movement in the price level results solely from changes in the quantity of money. basically, in general terms, we can say that there are lots of things that are not working at the moment in the modern economies. So we have seen huge changes in the quantity of money. Have we seen changes in the price level? No. But we have to start from something to be able to figure out what is the role of central banks in doing monetary policy actions in general. There are lots of things that are not holding anymore. So we have to skip many of the assumptions of the original quantity theory of money nowadays. But it gives you a nice sort of a starting framework to do this analysis between the relevant variables. So the quantity theory of money says that in terms of the demand for money, when you divide both sides by the velocity of the money, then you get the amount of money to be given by 1 over velocity times the nominal aggregate output. When the money market is in equilibrium, which means that all the supply that is being given by the central bank, so the left-hand part here is solely given by the central bank, it is being demanded, so it is being used. We have the money market equilibrium. Remember that we don't have the interest-yielding asset markets here at all yet. In the next step, we will be introducing the role of those also. So we are starting to discuss about the liquidity premium framework introduced by Keynes. But basically, you could say in this very simple world that the money demand should be in some kind of positive connection to the nominal production, aggregate production, with the multiplier K that is defined based on the level of velocity. So when velocity increases, K decreases. That's the main thing that you have to understand from here. When the velocity decreases, K increases. It's a reciprocal of wave. So because K is constant, in this case, the level of transactions generated by a fixed level of nominal income determines the quantity of money demand. So the nominal income is the only thing that determines money demand. Well, to a certain extent, it might be the case nowadays because the interest rate is really, really low. You are not paying too much attention to the opportunity cost of holding more money because it's pretty much zero. If you want to have more interest yielding assets in your portfolio, they are not basically yielding almost anything to you at the moment. And for some customers, biggest customers of the banks, they even have to pay for doing deposits, for making deposits to the banks. So the demand for money is not affected by interest rate. It might be the case actually nowadays that the demand for money is not actually very much, at least given by the level of interest rates. But so from the equation of change to the quantity theory of money, we get this relationship. So Fisher's view is that velocity is fairly constant in the short run, but in the longer run, it can change. So basically, by imposing this assumption that V is equal to something constant in short terms, it changes to the equation of exchange. It changes the equation of change in the quantity theory of money, which states that nominal income is determined solely by movements in the quantity of money. So we want to sort of switch the discussion towards the things that the central bank can have an effect on. So in this case, the central bank is affecting the quantity of money. And based on this quantity theory of money, it should have an effect on the nominal income, nominal GDP. If it's increasing money supply, it's increasing nominal income. Well, it's actually kind of a relevant idea still, but there are lots of things going on that seems to be disturbing this channeling of the money supply changes to the real economy. One of the things is the behavior of the banks. They are not basically behaving in the way that Irving Fisher originally sort of figured. They are not behaving like that. So if there's more liquidity given to the banking sector, it's not channeled to the real economic activities, at least to the degree that the central bank is assuming. So basically, it's once again, it's the decision of the banking sector, not the central bank. Central bank would like to see that excess liquidity to be channeled to the real economic activity, but it has not gone there. So we have been talking about these classical economists. So Fisher and Friedman are the classical economists that we want to refer to here. So they thought that wages and prices are completely flexible. Is this another thing? Is this working? No. In modern economies, it's not actually the case. So it might be some of the reasons that actually have an effect here in the channeling of money supply changes to the real economic activity. We don't have completely flexible prices. We don't have completely flexible wages. So we don't have these full employment levels in the economies. That is not the case. We are actually experiencing in the Finnish economy now, based on the corona experience, we are now having a situation where our structural unemployment is increasing. So the guys that have been laid out at the beginning of the crisis seem to be more or less permanently unemployed, or the number of those guys has increased quite a lot, or work amount of labor force in belonging to that classification. But nevertheless, this should give you some kind of idea about the effects of money supply changes on the real economic activity. But there are lots of things that were assumed originally that actually don't hold nowadays. But if you want to analyze in this, so if you want to go from the considering of stock values, levels of these variables, to the actually measured things that are, for example, given in the Taylor rule, then you would have to be moving towards discussing differences or changes in these variables. Okay, so you can, and you should define actually this quantity theory in terms of changes, relative changes in variables, percentage changes. So if you remember that percentage change in these two values, X and Y, if you take a product of those, and they are log values originally, then basically you can calculate the joint percentage change as a sum of those log changes. So percentage change in X measured as a log change or relative change, X at the current period minus X at the previous period divided by the X at the previous period to get the relative change. But an approximation for that, good enough approximation when you don't have very high levels for these variables originally, is a logarithmic, natural logarithmic approximation. So you can get the percentage change in that and percentage change in the other variable. So basically, you can analyze these variables in the quantity equation, quantity theory equation, based on these things that we observe or would like to observe or use also in the Taylor. So the percentage change in the price level refers to the inflation. And usually we are interested about the annual inflation. So even though you are measuring the inflation or original price levels at monthly frequency, you are interested what is the change in this year's January compared to the previous year's January. So that's an annualized change. Take a log difference between those, using a natural logarithm. So basically, we can rewrite, actually, using this approximation there, we can rewrite the equation of exchange as a sum of change, percentage change in the supply of money, and percentage change in the velocity of money. So we are now basically allowing that it might be also possible that the velocity is changing. But we here in the following slide, assume that it's not changing the original model, but it might be changing. But the most important thing here is that actually we have on the right-hand side now, we have the variables that are included to the Taylor model, actually. So there's the inflation, percentage change in inflation, and percentage change in GDP. growth in GDP. If we subtract the nominal GDP change from both sides of this equation, then we get the representation for the inflation. So subtract this guy from both sides and you get to this representation. So you still have the velocity change there. So it might change, but in the original model of Fisher, we assume that it doesn't change in short term. But nevertheless, in the original model, it was assumed that this is zero. So basically, this gives you an idea that what are the main things that have an effect on inflation. They are the changes in the money supply that is more or less completely dictated by the central bank. And then the changes in the thing that the central bank basically cannot control, that is the change in the real economic activity, because that's dependent on you guys. How do you behave if you get more money to be used? Do you want to increase your consumption? Do you want to increase your investments? Does the public sector want to increase their purchases and so on? So we assume that the velocity is constant, growth rate is zero. So the quantity theory of money says that it's a theory also for the inflation. There are two things that have an effect on inflation. And that actually gave also the reason for John Taylor to empirically include also the real activity deviations, because this is now actually referring to the monetary policy rule and the actual sort of actions that the central bank can do are either increasing the money supply or lowering the interest rate, like the Fed funds target rate. It's an loosening monetary policy action. So it's something that's there in the Taylor rule, and there's also inflation. And inflation gets to be included basically twice because based on the so-called Phillips equation, the changes in real economic activity also have an effect on inflation. So this is actually already referring to the future developments of these theories regarding the monetary policy actions or relationships between the variables. So do these originally quite nice, intuitively understandable and easy assumptions hold in the actual data. In the data before the most recent observations in the US case, we do have this positive correlation between the interest rate measured at the percentage annual rate and money growth rate. And that's the simple message from the Fisherian analysis or the Friedman type analysis. We basically have a positive relationship. When this is low, it's also low here. And when it's high, it's also, these are point estimates, point observations from some years during 1870s until 2000. But in the most recent data, the US economy experienced this problem of very low interest rates. So basically money growth rate sort of lost its connection also to the inflation rate. So it's perhaps more relevant to take a look at the countries where the developments were a bit different, like, for example, the developing countries of Turkey, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, and so on. Do you have these kind of relationships there? And you seem to have. So basically some kind of quantity theoretical money supply model might be working in the developing countries that have not experienced these zero levels of interest rates and the sort of a total disconnection of money supply and the inflation rates there. So there might be reasons. This sort of emphasizes for you the really the need to take a very close look at the economy that you are considering. What is the most recent or the historical experiment with the interest rates? What is the experiment with the currency value? What is the experiment with the money supply? and inflation rates if you want to analyze these kind of things. Like, for example, there's the Taylor rule there in these countries. So basically, in empirical terms, before the really problematic period of zero lower bound and negative interest rates in the ECB area, we have historical evidence that the quantity theory of money, the Fisherian ideas, might actually have held to a degree. But this current situation has destroyed this quite nice theoretical, really simple thinking, more or less completely. So it also is a good example of having really unconventional times at the moment in terms of these variables. Okay, so we basically only have time to take a look at this empirical observation regarding the US inflation and money growth rates in the US economy until the most recent observations. And I have not drawn this to the most recent observations because you actually get the idea about the more or less complete disconnection between these quantity theoretical variables after the global financial crisis. They are not talking to each other in the way that Irving Fisher originally assumed. So this is really important for you to realize that if you are using data for any kind of analysis, for example, your monetary policy analysis or fiscal policy analysis, or you want to do analysis regarding the development, for example, the growth theoretical analysis. Let's say that you want to analyze the connection between real economic growth and financial market development. You have to take care of these things if you are using the data from after 2008 crisis, because the countries have really different experiences from each other regarding these variables. So the development of funds markets with respect to the enhancing the growth prospects has been really different for example, the US case and also the European countries, euro area countries, compared to some developing countries. Where, for example, the development of banking sector might have a role to do still there, and also different role compared to the development of stock markets, for example. So the direct channel of funding intermediation might have a different role there compared to the indirect channel that we have been discussing also in this course. So my simple message from this speaker is that if you want to use the data after 2008, pay attention to the more or less complete collapse of all the standard macroeconomic simple ideas that connect the monetary policy or the monetary or money market related variables, for example, the real economic activity. And the main reason is these unconventional monetary policy actions. Normal part does not play the same kind of role as it did before global financial crisis. So it's not just enough to control for the really, really exceptional years of corona crisis. You have to control for basically everything else also, right from the global financial crisis. Okay, so I think that we should continue tomorrow. So let's continue from this discussion of these budget deficits and inflation. And after that, you should be able to also do the weekly quiz test in the Moodle. Okay, thank you and see you tomorrow.